quorum present, those present, we will be on a listen-only teleconference. Myself as chair, Georgiana Lincoln, co-chair, Representative Pat Carney, Representative John Gonzalez, Representative Sherry Davis. And we should be joined shortly by Representative Mark Hanley and Representative Mary Miller, and Representative Betty Davis has been excused. We will start out our committee with the hearing of SB 52, and if Senator Duncan could come and join us at the table. Welcome and good morning, Senator.
Good morning. Thank you. We are on teleconference?
Listen only.
Okay. Great. Thank you. I'll do a very brief explanation of the bill, if I might, and then I would be available for chance of questions, or there may be other delays that you can answer if I can. Senate Bill 52 does several things. One, increases the number of members of the Governor's Council on the Handicapped and Gifted from 23 to 26. That change is contained in Section 1. This change was necessitated because the Governor's Council was also designated to serve as the Interagency Coordinating Committee for Public Law 99457, the 1986 Education and Handicapped Act amendments affecting children from birth to 3 years of age. In other states, the Interagency Coordinating Committee has been established as a separate 15-member board charged with planning services for handicapped children between the ages of birth to 3 years. In order to blend the council and the Interagency Coordinating Committee into one body, a 26-member body is necessary, and I do have the composition of that body that I can read to you if you desire. It does have 5 representatives of specific agencies or consumer groups, 8 state agency representatives, including those administering federal funds provided through certain federal offices, 4 representatives of departments providing services to people with disabilities, including the Division of Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities, the Deputy Commissioners of DOE and HESS, who represent more than one division or program, or the Department of Community and Regional Affairs, and includes 13 primary and secondary consumers representing different age groups, types of disabilities, and geographic distribution. The reason for increasing the membership of the Governor's Council on the Handicapped and Gifted by only 3, or by doing that, we can accomplish the additional planning required by the federal legislation without adding an entirely new board. As I said, in some states they have added a second board. This legislation would propose we just increase the present council by 3 and accomplish the same purpose. Section 2 of the bill provides for selection of the executive director of the council by the council pursuant to new federal requirements. That's in Public Law 101-496, states that each state planning council shall, consistent with state law, hire a director of the state planning council who shall be supervised and evaluated by the state planning council and who shall hire and supervise the staff of the state planning council. So we are providing by law in Section 2 that the council will hire the new executive director. I might add at this time, and I know someone from the department is here, I think originally the department had a position paper as in opposition to Section 2 during the last committee hearing in the Senate, and I think you should ask the department today. They have changed that position, and they are now in support of leaving the bill as it passed by leaving Section 2 in the bill that would allow the council to hire the director. Section 3 amends the state definition of developmental disability to comply with the federal definition. This amendment will allow severely physically handicapped individuals to receive services such as respite care, daycare, homemaking, and community living services. State law provides for such services only for mentally handicapped individuals. That, Madam Chair, is the legislation. I would urge the committee to support it.
Thank you. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And excuse me, before we go on, let the records note that Representative Hanley is also.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Duncan, just a quick question. There's 2 zero fiscal notes in here, and if you're adding people, how can you get to 0 fiscal notes? I guess I'm just curious. It seems like there should be at least a small one for an additional cost of somebody coming to the meetings or something. And you're also adding an executive director, and you have
no. Well, if I might reply to that we're not adding an executive director. There's already an executive director. It's just we're changing the way that executive director is appointed. There's presently an executive director for the council. on handicapped and gifted and disappointed by the governor. We're changing from state law to comply with what the federal law says we can do. As far as the additional three people and the physical impact they would have, I guess the department believes that there would not be any additional physical impact that was considered. And Mr. Bertram or someone here from the department would probably respond to that.
Senator Duncan, I also had a question on the fiscal note, and that is on the DHSS fiscal note, the analysis that's there. It says provision for services would be contingent upon the funding requested by the mental health board and the governor.
As I interpret what that means is, of course, there is a certain level of funding provided right now for individuals with developmental disabilities. These individuals, expanded definition, would be added to that list. If we don't increase funding, there would just be an increased wait list. So it would be really a decision, one, on a funding request by the mental health board and the governor, or secondly, the legislature could increase funding, I guess, through the budget process to do that. But if we don't do it for fiscal, that would be, mean that there would be an increased waiting list with the expansion of the definition.
Thank you. Are there further questions? If not, apparently Tom Bergstrom is here for the department, and perhaps we can hear from the department.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Bergstrom from the Department of Health and Social Services. I think Senator Duncan has accurately represented the what this bill would do. As he pointed out, initially we were opposed to Section 2 on further investigation with counsel. We believe that the ability of the council to name its own executive director is mandatory, and so we have removed our objection to that. We'll prepare a new position paper reflecting that. As far as the fiscal note goes, we currently have a wait list of about 400. And in our view, it would have been improper to take this group, which may be as many as 700 individuals, and leapfrog them ahead of the current waiting list of 400. We believe that it's more proper to establish the definition and allow the mental health board and the legislature to speak to the acceptable size of a wait list. There are budget increments proposed by the mental health board, also the department, in the house budget addresses some, although certainly not all, of the current request.
Questions? Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I did understand that part. I was curious about the cost of having additional members on the council.
Three members. It was our view, based on previous lapses of funds by the Governor's Council for the handicapped and gifted, that the agency within its existing funding was able to absorb the incremental travel costs of those three members.
Further questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Davis.
Madam Chair, I move that SB 52 be passed in committee with individual recommendations.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. There was another person who wanted to testify.
I withdraw that motion.
I appreciate that. I'm sorry, I overlooked it. Tim Weiss that has signed up to testify. Weiss.
Yes, I represent.
Would you state your name?
Yes, I'm Tim Weiss. I represent the Alaska Alliance for Deaf Children. We are one of the groups that requested that this, the change in the definition of developmental disability, be presented. One of our reasons is that currently a number of services are not being provided to deaf children. One of them is that respite care is not being provided to deaf children. They're simply not eligible, even though other children with such disabilities as dyslexia, I believe, are. For example, when I first found out that my son was deaf, my daycare provider immediately said, "I'm sorry, I'm not going to take him anymore." And I was immediately left to fend for myself and immediately try to find somebody else. It's rather difficult to find daycare for deaf children. The situation's actually a lot worse in the bush, and I'm hoping this will solve the problem in the bush. One of our situations that we had recently, a few months ago in the bush, is a situation in which the parents of a deaf child about 7, 8 years old was told that his aunt was going to be his teacher and interpreter. She was handed a book, a sign language book, and told, here, you know, so what if you don't know sign language? You're now the child's instructor and teacher. They immediately raised a fuss and were told, well, you could always, you know, send your kid off to Anchorage to go to the deaf school down there. And the family, being a traditional native family, thought that that was totally ridiculous and was hoping to find somewhere to provide, that funding could be provided to move the whole family down to Anchorage. HNSS was approached on that and immediately told, oh, I'm sorry, deaf children just aren't covered under this definition. You'll just have to put up with whatever, you know, system is available. This is a completely unreasonable response in our opinion, and we're hoping that this definition will solve this problem. This situation, unfortunately, is not going to have a happy ending anymore, because the child in question there just died a few months ago of a house fire because he couldn't hear the fire alarm. We were trying to raise money on our own to get him and his family out of there, but it's too late now. We've just had another request from another bush village that's very similar. We're hoping that this time we won't have to tell them, I'm sorry, you're just not eligible. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that SB 52 be passed from committee with individual recommendations.
Any objection? Hearing no objection, it is ordered. We're on to education bills now, so we're going to do a little rotation here. And let the record reflect also that Representative Miller has joined our meeting.
Let the meeting come back to order. This is Representative Carney chairing the co-chair chairing the meeting for education bills. The first bill we're going to take up was not on our schedule, held over from a previous meeting, is House Bill 23. And I'll ask for a report from the chairman of the subcommittee that was dealing with this bill in committee, Representative Davis. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I briefly went over the bill. Representative Larson was told me he'd be unable to be here this morning, and I told him I'd take good care of his bill. As you know, we've amended the bill pretty dramatically. We've essentially turned the idea of the whole reports on and methodology and calculations of area cost differential part of the formula over to the Department of Education in this bill. And Kruger requested that the Department of Education prepare a new report that we can have by the beginning of the session next year. My intent with that information would be to use that information along with information I hope will be forthcoming with the Joint School Performance Committee and prepare a new foundation formula using all of the pieces and parts that we need in order to do that. And this would be one piece of that. Representative Larson, the sponsor of the bill, supports this new version, and we do have today a fiscal note, which is what we were waiting for, a new fiscal note. It seems to have gone down instead of up, so that would be good news, and I offer this bill for your consideration. I think it's a good bill.
Questions from members of the committee, President Gonzalez?
Oh. Well, actually, what I was gonna do is if there's not any questions, I was ready to move, but there might be some questions. We worked on this quite a bit, and I think we've all talked about it. And unless somebody's had some problems with it or questions, and if it's not out of order yet, I move that we move the bill out of hand.
Objection? Your objection to order. Representative Brown here. The next bill on our agenda will be House Bill 203. Representative Brown, would you please? House Bill 203 with Representative Brown comes to the table, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm happy to have the opportunity to discuss House Bill 203. Are we also discussing House Bill 204 this morning, I hope, which is its companion appropriation measure? This bill, House Bill 203, would establish the Alaska Education Technology Fund in the Department of Education. The purpose of the fund is to provide one-time grants to public elementary and secondary schools to purchase, install, and maintain education technology in the classroom. And I think this is a really exciting concept and could do a lot to improve the quality of education throughout our state. The Commissioner of Revenue would be the designated treasurer of the fund, and the grants from the fund would be given out by an education or recommendations made by an education technology grant committee that would consist of 7 members appointed by the governor. And the committee, as composed in the legislation, would have a variety of members. 4 would be educators with demonstrated technique, demonstrated expertise in education technology from a variety of sizes of districts. 1 would be someone with expertise in this field who is employed by the University of Alaska. 1 would be an employee of the Department of Education and also with expertise in this area, and then 1 public member. The committee would review grant requests using specified criteria and award grants to individual schools or school districts. And there are 2 important points to keep in mind. First, the criteria is designed to allow local control by individual schools in making applications. And 2nd, it specifies opportunities for training for teachers, which I feel is critical if people are to effectively use and employ education technology in the classroom. The bill also expands the duties of the state library system and would allow the state library to provide grants to all publicly funded libraries to expand and update database and information network systems. And the LaserCat Compact Disc Library Index is one example of such a system. Mr. Chairman and members, there are, I understand, a number of people who want to speak on this bill, and I just ask all of them to remember we don't want to talk this bill to death. And I know there's a lot of positive enthusiasm out there for it, but I'd ask the speakers to be very concise in their comments to the committee. I think the idea is very positive. In the Anchorage Caucus, we have worked on getting computers in the Anchorage schools. Governor Cooper vetoed our attempt at this in the last legislative session, and one of the things he said in his letter was that he felt it might be unconstitutional to do this only in certain districts or only in Anchorage, and that was one of the things that got me thinking about a statewide approach to this so that we would have equal education and equal opportunity throughout our state. And I think many people recognize the value and the benefit of doing it, and it comes down to how are we going to pay for it, and where does it stand in the list of priorities of all the many needs that our state has. House Bill 204 would appropriate $60 million for this to the Education Technology Fund and $3 million to the state libraries. Right now, this is specified to come from the general fund. I've also considered 2 other potential funding sources. One would be the Science and Technology Fund, which I think this proposal does fit with the overall goal of that initiative, which was to improve our applications of technology. And I think putting this type of technology in the schools would certainly be consistent with that. Secondly, I've thought about the possibility, in the event we're not able to find funds for it, of putting it up for a vote, a statewide bond. And it would be something that people throughout the state would vote on, and in that event, we'd have to have support and help from the education community, which I have been contacted by a large number of people since introducing the bills, and I think there is broad support in the education community for this approach. So there are others who will describe more specifically what types of programs are envisioned in the classroom and how this will benefit people in the classroom. So I thank you very much for taking up these bills, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Brown. We have a handout, Education in the Industrial Age and Information. Is this from your office, or it hasn't been handed?
No, sir. I haven't seen it.
Just wanted to check. It looks like we'll have it out here in just a minute.
Okay.
Any questions from members of the committee? Representative Davis.
Just a real quick one, Representative Brown. It's my understanding, in fact, it's my knowledge, is that there are very different levels of available technology depending on the school district's body. There are districts who have spent money and put money into technology, and there are districts that have not. And is that not a fact?
Yes. And if I might just comment briefly on that point. In thinking about this, I thought, well, maybe to get the cost down, we should eliminate the schools that have already spent money on this. And then the more I thought about it and talked with people about it, I felt that it's not a good idea to penalize the people who have been leaders. And also recognizing that technology does change, and a school might have word processors, or they might have a computer lab, or some level, but still they would not, probably most schools in our state do not have the state-of-the-art equipment that this bill envisions, and that would be interactive, where people would have video as well as sound, and powerful machines that will do more than just what my belief is that most schools have at this time. So I think it is positive for the schools that have already recognized the benefits of this type of technology, where the teachers are involved, they're working on curricula, to give those people also the opportunity to access a higher level of technology.
I have a number of questions. I was just thinking maybe after I heard the others, since you have 101 other people to testify, waiting until then, but I'll just ask a couple at this point. One is that this is one of the areas that I really supported in going around from village to village, the idea of using different technology for teaching, especially when we have one teacher out there who's teaching 12 grades or teaching 8 grades at the minimum. And children who are reading from books and not having the proper instruction from the teacher just because of time. And then I went and I saw a school that was having a test or a model site from IBM computers, and that was ANIAC. And those were preschool children that were there, preschool and kindergarten, I guess they had combined, and they were into their, I believe, third week of instruction when I got there. And they did not know I was coming, so it was just a spontaneous demonstration that the students had for me. And I was so impressed with those kids, those very young children, who went to the computer, turned it on, and said, enter, as they were speaking the words as they were hitting the button that said enter, and were getting instruction without an instructor there through the different software on the IBM computers. and I was very impressed by that. But I'm concerned on page three that oftentimes those small schools, we don't have the expertise to write the grants in competing with the urban schools who have expert grant writers and so forth. And in reviewing, it says in reviewing the grant applications that they're going, the consideration will be given on this.
Which one?
I'm on 21 right now. It would be 18 down.
Page three.
That on page three. And shall consider the schools or the district's provisions for initial and ongoing training for teachers in curriculum application and implementation. If you only have one teacher out there, or two teachers out there, sometimes the ongoing training for teachers, it would have to be on site, that those teachers cannot leave the school, as you can have substitutes in urban settings. And I don't want to see anything in this bill that is going to be a roadblock for rural schools, because that's where I think this is going to be most helpful. And that's what my concern is.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lincoln, I agree with everything you said, and that is an excellent point of the opportunities this type of approach provides for helping raise the quality of what's available, especially in a situation where one teacher is covering many fields and many grades. If the committee would look to line 25 of page 3, my vision, I recognize that some of the problems of how are we going to have an effective training program throughout the state, not only for teachers, but for the kids and some of the people that are going to be using it. And I would envision that this committee, which will have people with expertise in the field, will develop a program so that the training can be effectively implemented. And I think I've heard different educators spin out different scenarios for how that might occur effectively, both on-site and in regional centers where teachers would go for an intense week training program or several days or whatever was required. One thing about this, the reason partly that it's so expensive, is that it does not envision competition in the traditional sense where we have a limited pot of dollars and there's competition who can get there first with the best application. What's envisioned here is enough money to provide this technology in every classroom in Alaska and give every student the 3 hours of hands-on training, hands-on exposure to the computer a week, and that the I believe that the proposal, the money and the projections would be sufficient to do that, to provide enough so that there would be enough for everyone to access it, and so we wouldn't be pitting different regions against each other or different schools against each other, that they would all have the opportunity, and that what's envisioned by the criteria is we just want to make sure that schools have a workable plan, that they have thought through what they're going to do with it, how they're going to implement it, so that we don't just have a situation of people buying the technology and the box is sitting there because nobody is really has an effective plan to use it. So we would envision, I would envision that this training actually would take place in advance of people or in conjunction with people developing their plans and submitting their applications. So I think there is envisioned enough support here to help even the smallest schools participate in the program.
Yes, thank you. One other question that I've got is in the same line is, if you go to line 24, it says, shall use a per student per teacher guideline for the distribution of the funds. And my continuing concern is that that school, and I'll take Rampart as an example, that has 23 students, but it's K through 12, with we managed to just eke by and get one more teacher, two teachers, that if we're going to have one computer, because we've got 23 students, one computer for grades K through 12, and Anchorage, as an example, gets a computer for every classroom, that first grade, second grade, third grade, fourth grade, you know, they get 12 computers because they happen to have more teachers than we do. One computer in Rampart is not sufficient to do what I envision this to do. So I'm opposed to this per student, per teacher guideline, and I think that there's some other way that we could accomplish it.
Well, I'm certainly flexible. This was a suggestion from people who've been working, or educators and people who have looked at this. I believe this is set up to provide about one computer for every 10 students and one computer for every classroom teacher. So just using those rough guidelines, that would be, as I would see the Rampart 3, one for the teacher and two for the 20 students, you know. I don't know how, that's something the committee would have to look at in figuring that out. I mean, this is not intended to be a rigid thing that says, you know, so much per, but it's a guideline to help ensure that there is that equitable distribution throughout the state. And I'm certainly flexible and open to suggestions, and perhaps the testifiers could comment on that too, as to what would be a good way to do that.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Brown. I do share your enthusiasm for getting computers into the classroom. And in fact, my opinion on that is so well known in my district that last time when I was home, I was a little bit surprised to be approached by a PTA president who then proceeded to tell me her concerns, and I wanted to share them with the committee, because I think on page 3, probably around line 20, and that paragraph B probably will address her concerns. She said to me that before we have computers so readily available in the classroom, she, as a parent and a PTA volunteer, felt that we should be certain that the students were actually in an educational program mode. She felt that oftentimes the computer time in the classroom, and these were her opinions, that the computer time was more or less a plaything. Perhaps the teacher didn't really have the time for the instruction, or there was no real set direction to the student, and that she felt also that it just might be a way for the teacher to have more time with some of the students that needed additional help, and so others were said, well, go and use the computer and that kind of thing. So I wasn't convinced of all of her arguments, but that is a perception out in the public. And I think, too, just my observation is that a lot of parents seeing young people playing with screens and computers just translate into the experience of the Nintendo and all the games. I think a lot of families, their first experience with that kind of high tech were the games, and so they assume that if children are using that this is fun play and not serious learning. So I would just reiterate that it's so important that there be an initial and ongoing training for teachers in curriculum application, and since we're told that there will be one computer for every 10 students and one for the teacher, that does mean that not all students at one time in one classroom will be at the computer. So I think it's important for the community at large to understand what this bill involves, because the money involved too, I think there may be some questions, and I'm wondering if you had heard any of those concerns raised.
Yes, I have. And one thing that I agree generally with your observations, the curricula is developing at a pretty rapid rate. for teaching language, for teaching math and science and all types of subjects, and it's really, I think, following up on the point Representative Lincoln made, going to give teachers who have to cover many, many subjects a lot of resources to draw on that they don't have now. So yeah, I think the other thing too is that if this technology is properly implemented, it can actually change the way that education is delivered by having a small number of computers in each classroom and having people work in teams to develop projects on the computers. We're not just envisioning something that would be a computer lab down the hall where people would go to do word processing or drill and practice type things, but actually becoming involved in the creative process, in research, and in learning to apply the things that they are to be able to develop their own little software programs that document their history, their culture, and that type of thing. It's a very exciting concept, and I think it will have a big impact on changing how education is actually delivered, from making it just a lecture situation to a more participatory situation, with the teachers very involved in orchestrating that.
A follow-up with a comment. It's my belief that the youngsters that are now in our classroom will be so dependent on technology, and I've heard it said, and I'm beginning to believe it, that libraries with books and using books as a tool in the classroom, which is what I grew up with, will almost become obsolete because they will be so outdated so quickly that that books may go the way of scrolls. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Miller. Further comments, Representative Davis.
Mr. Chairman, this is probably going to sound a little like a broken record to my committee members, but I get kind of nostalgic from time to time to think about the good old days. In the good old days, when we had enough money in schools, there was a short period of time, admittedly, when that was, I felt that was the case. I know my district, Ketchikan, was pretty much a leader in some of the technology and spent a lot of money on buying computers, training teachers, putting programs together for all the level, grade levels, etc. What's happened, though, as with everything else we talk about around here, is as the money has not increased and thus decreased, Ketchikan is probably in the way of a lot of other school districts right now, in that we may have some, we've got computers, some of them are obsolete or have broken or whatever, as these things do over a period of time, and new people coming in are not getting the training they need because there isn't money to do that sort of thing. There just isn't money to put the focus on this. We're trying to, you know, just do basics. And so I do support all of this. I think Representative Lincoln raised some very good concerns, and I would hope, in fact, would have asked the chairman with a note if we could have just a short period of time, perhaps, with do a subcommittee on this to maybe look at that language and see, ensure that it's going to do the kinds of things that we want it to do.
Thank you, Representative Davis. Further comments from the committee? We have a number of people who want to testify. Representative Brown, we have this gadget that showed up here. Is that from you? And if so, do you plan a demonstration?
If I could defer to this gentleman.
Apparently, this is a demonstration of some sort. Perhaps we should see that before we start taking testimony.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
you come to the microphone and identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is David Langford, and I'm the computer coordinator and continuous improvement process coordinator at Mount Edgecombe High School.
I'm Larry Roschlow, superintendent at Mount Edgecombe High School, and also I'm director of educational program support for Department of Education right now, so I'm wearing two hats. And Lisa Polk is also with us from Mount Edgecombe High School. She's a junior at Mount Edgecombe, and if we could, Mr. Chairman, if we could show you some of the programs, and I'll just turn it over to David at this point as to what we're going to show you.
What I wanted to really point out is that the higher level thinking skills in which the technology begins to let people expand versus the old concept that we use technology as a drill and practice tool or a slave-master relationship. And what you have on the screen there is what's called a HyperCard program. And this particular one was developed through a class that we have called Science and Technology, in which the goal there is to classify all plants that are on Japonski Island, where the school's located. And this is a particular plant is the Yarrow plant. And what the students do is go out and collect the plants, dry them, and then digitize the image and bring that into the computer. So that's the actual dried image of the plant. And if you click on the flower, Lisa, it gives you the student begins to build a document like this. So what the students are actually doing is building their own textbooks. And they use a variety of materials then in research to be able to pull this all together in a highly motivational atmosphere. And as you keep clicking, you start to get more and more parts. And if you click on the center of the flowerlet, you'll get another breakdown. And the creativity in this is incredible because the graphics can be brought in that are already pre-generated through other mediums, or they can be created by students. Or we have the capability now of taking microscopic slides and doing cross sections of leaves, and then inputting that image directly into the HyperCard stack, and then the students can be able to build their own information around it. So what you're seeing is a whole new concept in which is slowly replacing the old book report. And what we find is that this is also taking the limit off the top for top-end students, that there is no limit now for getting an A. The goal is to see how much you can learn in the shortest amount of time. I wanted to give you one brief handout. That talks about the new focus in terms of the student-teacher relationship. That on the left-hand side, it's the master-slave relationship, and as you move to the right, the lecture situation where the teacher's all-knowing provider and the student's a passive recipient. And then we've finally gotten into the coaching atmosphere that the extracurricular activity's been in for years, but classrooms are just now starting to understand facilitation and cooperative learning. And what we're really after is the one to the right, in which the teacher acts as a mentor and a provocateur, and the student becomes a self-activated learner. And that takes a whole new concept in terms of management skills and philosophies of how people relate and interrelate with the technology. And I think that addresses some of the questions that came up previously about these things being tools versus being an interactive part of the curriculum and really being something. I see that we have two major problems. One is that we have technology out in rural schools, and I've worked in several rural districts that is not in use because of lack of training, teacher training, and not understanding how to use this as an interactive tool. And the second one is we have training going on for people in districts, but no tools to use it. And that's like a cruel joke. That people go and see these kinds of things and see the possibilities of what could be happening, but no wherewithal to make it happen. Mount Edgecombe has enjoyed quite a bit of notoriety for our use in technology. We have right now around 100 computers for 200 students, which is a 2-to-1 ratio. That seems like a massive amount of technology, but every time we ask the students to prioritize needs for what they think they need to be able to do a better job, the computers continually come up at the top of the list. We got that kind of a ratio not through money from the general fund, but primarily money that we got through grants and scrounging and working and finding more and more ways to put money directly into program improvement, and at the same time training teachers about how to interact with this. Our curriculums are being totally restructured. Our biology curriculum is now textbooks sit on shelves as resources. The students build HyperCard stacks like this based on their own body structures. It becomes personal, it becomes relevant. Very low-end students are suddenly, the handcuffs are taken off of them. They're no longer the people that are being whipped in the class as being failures and that kind of thing. Top-end students are are taking off in the directions that we never dreamed possible before. One of the exciting things that we're just implementing currently is a language lab for Chinese, Japanese, and Russian language teaching using the same kinds of technologies and using laser discs and interactive video training and allowing students to be able to get access to these tools. One of the greatest benefits that we've seen happen at Mount Edgecombe and a model that we're trying to propose to other school districts is to open up the school in more of a 24-hour concept, and that what a lot of the real learning that takes place where we're at takes place at night and on weekends, in which students have access to the technology.
I'd like to make a comment about teacher training in particular. I think that Representative Lincoln's remarks are very appropriate in that it's really difficult to take those two teachers out of the classroom, especially during the regular school year when there's only two teachers all together. And so how we see that coming about, or at least a way to help that to take place, would be through a distance delivery system. And we've got capabilities right now of doing that. And so I would see that we could provide help to the rural communities. Another thing we could do for the rural communities is to send out students who are well-trained in computers to work physically with other students who are in the bush. We could take Mount Edgecombe students right now and send them out into the bush if we had some kind of funding to do that. And I think our students could be excellent trainers out there. The other thing I think that needs to take place is Department of Education needs to be more of a leader in this whole thing and this whole movement. And I see DOE as being the leader in this kind of an arrangement that we're talking about with distance delivery, and with a bill such as this. This would give us the flexibility and the financial support that we would need in order to provide that teacher training. With that, Lisa, what comments would you like to make us?